Hello, and welcome to our 102nd COVID-induced distance-produced episode of Radio with a View on WMBR-FM, WMBR.org, and in the cloud at mixcloud.com/radiowithaview. Today's Radio with a View features a conversation with Dr. Catherine Rye Jewell, Professor of History at Fitchburg State University and co-director of the Library of Congress Radio Preservation Task Force. Our discussion focuses on her new book, Live from the Underground, A History of College Radio, published by the University of North Carolina Press. This conversation was recorded for Radio with a View on February 16th, 2024. One of the features of this kind of radio, and as somebody who would sit near the new releases all the time in the 1980s or 90s and run through them, sometimes frantically and sometimes at my leisure, are the question of indie and major labels. And you talked about alternative music, but it's also about the commercial nature of that music and how that worked. I was wondering if you could speak to the role of college radio in actually creating indie labels and making them a power, a cultural power. In a sense, it's a very weird paradox. You have a non-commercial system like college radio that is dramatically shaping commercial culture in the form of production of new genres and even the emergence of new distribution systems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really is a weird outcome because, and it really comes from the way that these stations reconfigure the idea of educational radio or alternative radio, that by doing that, by saying you can come to these stations and find things that you otherwise wouldn't hear on commercial radio, it pushes them further into playing new music, things that people otherwise haven't heard, or genres that aren't receiving coverage, which then makes them a really important place for the music industry to test a new product. So they, by leveraging that idea of educational radio, they actually make themselves more marketable, even as that concept of educational radio is very strongly kind of anti-commercial. And so what I like to say about the relationship of these stations between two changing music scenes and the changing business of music is that they don't create the music scenes, but what they help do is network them and share information across scenes and to generate this idea that what's happening in Chapel Hill might be interesting to people in Olympia, Washington, and vice versa. And so even though that was already happening through things like zines and different publications that were sharing information about upstart music movements, the radio stations were really helping to cement that process, that they were giving feedback to record stores about what was getting requests. They were showing venues like, hey, this band is really getting a lot of play. It's cool that you book them. They're getting a lot of requests. Like it backs up the other mechanisms through which music is starting to spread and build different fan bases. And all of that support then makes it really attractive for the major label industry. And so by around 1983, and especially as there is this pipeline to MTV as well, college stations and the DJs start to identify that once a band has crossed over to MTV or to commercial radio, it no longer needs our help. Like, we've done our work, and that kind of helps this further develop this space for college radio to be where the new music is coming from. And because there are more of these independent labels, because of shifts taking place within the music industry itself, they have a lot of product that they can play. And some of, not all of it they can play, but a lot of the hardcore music of the 80s that was not being sought. They were not looking to get played on radio. They didn't really care They dropped a lot of F-bombs and various things well, on the
let's talk a little bit about that hardcore. That's not primarily what I play, but I do mix it up with a combination of poetry and folk and jazz and blues and all sorts of stuff. But let's talk about that hardcore. One of the characters in your book, and I, by way of full disclosure, I know this person because we were at the same station together, started the same year, Steve Kreitzer, becomes an international figure.
Yes.
Creating networks of hardcore awareness in Europe, throughout the United States, among bands, among clubs, very straight in his presentation of self. But he was also a genius at creating these networks. And I was wondering if you could speak to that process, because it's transformative.
Yeah. And I mean, so much of what radio history we think about as what goes out over the airwaves. But for me, so much of radio history is what's going on when, you know, outside of the studio. And what was so amazing about what he did was he was very, very diligent and very consistent in the way that he tracked these networks and the questionnaires that he would send to bands and he would send them back. And then, and this is the really important thing that he did, he was then telling them when their music was getting airplay or requests, that it becomes a back and forth between the bands and the radio station and the venues and the music labels and the record stores. And so in that way, he's a conduit of information coming in and then going back out, at not just over the airwaves, but through paper. And so just going through the letters that he would receive from musicians talking about the show and the thank you notes. And, you know, and he was very diligent about sending notes to people about this that is, I think, is very rare. And so I think what he did is, because that process wasn't happening to the scale and the consistency that it was at his show, but in some form, a version of that was taking place. So it allowed me to really understand the logic going on behind the scenes at radio stations. So even though he's kind of taking it to the most extreme form in, I guess, institutionalizing it and documenting it, it allowed me to see what other DJs really had in mind when they were doing their shows and how they put music together, and to understand what it was that people were trying to do with these shows.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that's remarkable about what Steve did is that he actually shapes the presentation of other DJs who learn about this, think about what fits their particular style, and then bring that to bear in terms of their own shows and the bands that they're going to focus on or highlight and play. But as I said, when I asked the question initially, this becomes global. Mm-hmm. He is truly coordinating global musical exchange and global musical development from on his own. It's really quite remarkable.
I would love to see a map of all of his correspondence, because it's really amazing. I mean, Germany, Sweden, Italy, Japan, Argentina, like everywhere was sending, you know, somehow he was able to form this informational network that was informal, but becomes formalized because of the systems that he set up.